Political assassination and abuses of power affect us all. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KLRB-FM in Carmel, California. And now, Mae Brussel.
Good evening. This is Mae Brussel. This is Dialogue Conspiracy number 311, and it's the 5th of March in Carmel, California, 1978. I have some guests here with me that I'm very happy to have visiting. One guest here, Doug Wallace, an attorney from Oregon, down here working over the weekend, and Preston Truman from Salt Lake City, and another friend he has with him who is also in the room. Shy, we get on the air later, Monty. We have Monty here with us, too, from Salt Lake City. I don't know if you remember the name of Doug Wallace or not, but on Dialogue Conspiracy number 266, April 25th, it was almost a year ago, 1977, I talked about you on the program. I have the programs numbered and dated, and the listeners have collected these tape cassettes over the years, a lot of them, and new people join all the time. And then on Dialogue Conspiracy number 298, that was December the 4th, I talked about Douglas Wallace and his suit against the Howard Hughes people and confrontation you've been having with the Mormon Church. Talked about it on Dialogue Conspiracy. Would you like to introduce yourself for a moment on some of the points that I brought up just to review?
Yeah, sure, Mae. I've been working on my project with the Mormon Church for about 2 years now. I spent a lifetime preparing for it, it seemed like, and probably 3 or 4 years prior to starting out with the ordination of the Black in April of 1976. As I have developed and got into this thing, it has mushroomed into something which is far beyond what I ever expected to be in the beginning. I thought I had just some ecclesiastical error within the church to correct, but now I discover I've gotten very deeply into the aspects of the Mormon conspiracy and their world conquest ambitions.
Well, one of the things you wanted was to ordain a Black priest, right?
Well, what I wanted to do was to approve the equality of man.
Equality of man. I simplified it, but the act by which you were expressed it was to begin to let Black priests into the Mormon Church.
Yes, right, to try to break that long stigma.
And then the programs that we did on Dialogue Conspiracy were about your visit to Salt Lake City and the shooting of a plainclothesman that they mistook for you, another policeman.
Well, yes, that situation, of course, was where they were had me staked out overnight, the residence I was staying in, and the accident occurred at that time.
And a plainclothes person pulled up in front of the house, and another policeman across the street shot him and paralyzed him, right?
Yeah, no one really knows exactly how it happened. I have my own suspicions, but I believe that there was a certain amount of temper on the part of the one who was gesturing with his guns, referring to me that if I came out of the building that he would do that very thing, and he ended up accidentally shooting his partner across the...
How do you feel being almost a bullet away from death? Being inside of a house and another person is paralyzed? Where would have been you?
I felt pretty bad about it, but as a matter of fact, I was awake at the time, and I heard the shot, and my first thought was, my goodness, there must be some kind of a domestic quarrel in the neighborhood, but later turned out, of course, that it was this accident.
And you have a lawsuit about that now.
Yeah, so what I'm trying to do is to find out who the real culprit was. You see, they put some false information out that I had was going to come to Salt Lake with plastic bombs strapped to my body, and that I was going to blow up the presidency of the Mormon Church and so on. And this was a deliberate ruse to put me under a restraint to keep me from exercising my religious freedom.
Yeah, but even if you were under surveillance from the time you left Oregon and went to Salt Lake City, the way you handle a matter like that isn't to shoot in the middle of the night, early in the morning hours?
No, well, of course, to begin with, I've never made any threats of any type of violence, and that's not my history. And they have a file, very, very thick file on me, and they know better than to come up with that kind of a pretext. But nonetheless, all these men were armed, and church security personnel, heavily armed, attack dogs and pickups, and all types of things like this.
Yeah. You know, on this program, I refer to the people who are doing this research as freedom fighters. I compare us to the Lincoln Brigade in the Spanish Civil War, you know, that went over there and tried to fight fascism and called attention to fascism. As a matter of fact, today there's an anniversary celebration of a group of the men up in Northern California. One of those freedom fighters here is Preston, who's sitting next to me, who has given me invaluable material and research. I wanted to say a few words because I don't do this work all alone. I take newspapers and I read books and I send for information and I send for documents from the government and printing office. And then there's people that have given me just invaluable information, and they're part of a team. I'm not out there, you know, taking the glory or the credit. There's people that have been real freedom fighters. One of them that's visiting me this weekend is Preston. So I'd like you to, you know, say a few words about your contribution. What I want to say, Preston, is the person who first turned me in to the Mormon conspiracy, the Mormon church hierarchy, and the conspiracy in the government, and the links of the superintelligence agency to the Mormon church. It right. was Preston who sort of finalized or culminated the missing links in my research so I could go forward. You're a Mormon, aren't you?
No, I'm not.
Were you ever?
For a short period of time.
How long were you a Mormon?
Oh, about 6 years.
When did you catch on to the conspiracy of Mormons being high up in government and having conspiratorial intentions to maybe take the United States government, the Constitution? When did you first become aware of that?
Shortly after the Watergate break-in, when a surprising number of residents from Salt Lake City began showing up as either witnesses in the Watergate trials or participants in the cover-up and the planning of the burglary and other activities. And from there, it led me on into such things as the Howard Hughes Organization, the CIA, and back to the Kennedy assassination and that of Martin Luther King.
And there's other people in Salt Lake City working along with you.
Yes, there's quite a few people that are.
He has tremendous files. The Tanners write books about these conspiratorial links, and people have gone into the early books of the Mormon and the purposeful intent, sort of written like Mein Kampf, isn't it? Quite open about overthrowing the Constitution?
Well, the Mormon Church was founded in 1830, and by 1838, the president of the Mormon Church had already laid out a plan for the establishment of what he called the political kingdom of God, which was intended to take over the government of the entire world.
And do you think they're succeeding?
Well, from their positions they hold in the U.S. government and around the world, I think they're getting pretty close to being able to achieve some of their aims.
Well, I think the epitome of power is the use of the youth organization that is controlled by high Mormons to exclude paying federal taxes, having a tax write-off of the medical institute, and the manipulation of the courts, buying the governors, the presidents, Supreme Courts, the sheriff's departments, the police departments, the Congress. This has taken over.
I think also the way that they administer a lot of our intelligence agencies. For instance, when President Ford ousted Kissinger as head of the National Security Council, he appointed a Mormon from Utah by the name of Brent Scowcroft, who was in charge of almost all of the U.S. government intelligence agencies for quite some time. And when Carter came in, he resigned, and now, just a week and a half ago, Carter reappointed him back into management of some of the intelligence activities of the country.
So you have a list of 30 or 40 top people in the government that are Mormons, right?
That's right.
And they do say categorically that their loyalty is to the church before the country?
Right.
So that there is a question there of what decision they would make. There was so much of a worry about a Catholic president at one time. What do you think about this, Douglas? You know, they always worried about if a Catholic Kennedy became president, the Pope would take over.
Yes,
nobody
right.
talks about the Mormon.
No, they don't. One of the problems is that the Orthodox member of the Mormon Church is just about totally unaware of what the real ambition of the church hierarchy is. They're spoon-fed the nice little things, the family life programs, the nuclear family concepts and these things, and they're taught to be very obedient to their church, and their real thing is the church and nothing else. But the church itself, talking in terms of the top leadership, have some very diabolical plans for this world.
It's sort of like the American public at large. Your president and your congressman are given a place of respect and never challenged. And
yes.
People go home and earn a living. And
right. They're kept busy with busy work, and so they don't have time to look at the real serious problems that are confronting them on a daily basis.
And they don't see that those problems are purposely controlled, maybe.
No, not at all. Not at all.
I have some documents here that I think we should talk about. Doug came down here for the weekend, and Preston and Monty here to go over documents that were obtained from the hotel room of Howard Hughes in Mexico City when Howard Hughes, or if it was Howard Hughes, I don't like to refer to it as that person, when that body was cashed in Houston, Texas in April 1976. A lot of papers were left in Mexico, and there are only three sets of these documents, the Mexican papers, I understand, floating around in the United States today or anywhere, and one-third of them happened to be with us this weekend, and I'm very fortunate to have access to these documents. And we've gone over them. What are there, 4,000 documents you brought?
Approximately 4,000 documents.
Tons. It looked like that suitcase was way down, you know, about 4,000 documents. And we went over them till the early hours this morning and got up again this morning and started going through them. And, of course, my interest in them was that I've always believed that Howard Hughes didn't exist after the Boston trip, and certainly not in Las Vegas. And, of course, Preston, you know my work on that, on the Howard Hughes. So I wanted to see myself, and that's why they're here, partly for all of us to share and analyze what were the hotel the papers that were left at the Mexican hotel. What do you think? What is your summary or feeling about now that we've gone through these almost 3,000 pieces of paper?
I believe that someone was performing an alter ego of Howard Hughes, but I see no evidence of his actual physical presence there. I think that they had a body there that they pretended was Hughes, but I see no real evidence of a person being there as has been described by some of the writers regarding the condition of Hughes at the time of his alleged death, and I just don't think that we have that character existing in these documents.
In these 4,000 sheets.
No.
I was thinking that, oh my goodness, you know, maybe we'll find now handwritten memo after memo of Howard Hughes, and I will have to explain how this person was writing or simulating them, but when we went through these 3,000 or 4,000 pages, there isn't one handwritten memo.
Well, there are some handwritten memos, but nothing by Hughes.
Nothing by, no, I mean by Howard Hughes.
Right.
They were by Jack Reel. There isn't one out of these thousands of pages.
Not a one.
Not one. You as an attorney filed down in Houston, Texas, didn't you, to exhume that body that is allegedly Hughes?
Yes, I petitioned the court down there, among other things, to exhume the body to prove positive identification of Hughes. And, of course, they have refused to respond to that. They haven't even so much as given me the courtesy of a reply to my letter.
Do you think if you compile now from these documents and we pull out, like we've been doing over the weekend, the indications of chicanery, even in the person of Hughes, that would support your original file?
It might support the original file, probably would, but we may need more powder than that to get the authorities moving and to do something constructive.
What do you think of the documents overall, the things that were left in the Mexican hotel? What's your general opinion of these we've just read?
Well, by and large, I think that they were probably sanitized by the Hughes people there. The captors, and that they did, of course, overlook a few very vital documents, which I think can be very damaging to them, to some of them in particular. But by and large, I think that the documents are a farce in terms of having anything very meaningful to establish that Hughes was alive.
I know. Preston, you've been working on this, and I have for a long time, and we really couldn't wait till Wallace came to go through those. What's your opinion of the thousands of pages that we've been going through? How do you feel about the papers that were found?
Well, before I ever got a chance to look through these documents, I felt that Howard Hughes was never in Mexico, and he probably hadn't been alive since 1966. And after going through the documents, almost close to 4,000 pages, I was amazed that there is not one piece of evidence that shows the existence of a living, you know, person of Howard Hughes. Even the documents that are signed by Howard Hughes are suspect. The signatures are either almost one carbon copy of the other ones, or else we've got some where you can see where they wrote on or underneath Howard Hughes' signature, "Do not use," and pointed to the letters in Howard Hughes' name where they have misforged them. And I think it's amazing.
Yeah. Should we share some of these? I brought a few in, and should we read some
Why
of
not?
These?
Not
we can comment. There's one here. We can take turns. I've got one here. The Jack Anderson is a memo in the Mexican hotel that was confiscated. It said, "Jack Anderson won't retract any statements he made in his article," I guess it's about Howard Hughes, "because he never flatly accuses anyone. He just, in quotes, heard something or was told or it was rumored. No one today is beyond reproach, even Billy Graham or the Pope. There's no such thing as credibility since the Watergate incident started about 2 years ago."
That's right.
I think that's wonderful. Because when you think of the corruption of Pope Montini and the scandals around him and his OSS and drug dealing and the allegations of drug dealing days and Billy Graham with his funding by Mickey Cohn and the gang, they say there's nothing precious, and that was right.
That's true.
Yeah. How about you? You want to share one of those? These are some of the memos that we have, some favorite memos that we brought into the studio to read.
Y'all, here's one, a memo regarding Mayhew and the course of the trials. This particular memo It says Mayhew was pleading poverty, so if we win our counterclaims against Mayhew, we probably will not get any money to speak of. Anyway, the counterclaims were filed to protect our flanks from the IRS, etc., since Mayhew was alleging that you were part and parcel of the shenanigans. So, it's very comical, some of these memos.
Okay, Preston, you read one of the goodies.
Well, this is a May 12, 1975 memo from Nadine Henley, and it regards a doctor appointment for Howard Hughes to a Dr. Hughes. And Nadine said that she talked to Dr. Hughes, and he said that he could give he, meaning Howard Hughes, a checkup as soon as you were able to walk. He said that after you started walking, he will come here and give you the regular physical examination that is given to all applicants. And I think that's really funny that a doctor has to wait till his patient's walking before he can give him a physical.
Besides that, he was supposed to have broken his hip and not be able to walk, so the doctor can't come until he's walking. And that's pretty funny.
That really is.
Yeah, where's the one about Moe Dallas and Robert Mayhew? There's one here that is precious. It says, to my best of my recollection, I don't recall the date to contact Robert Mayhew, but I phoned Bob and went to his home. He was living with Moe Dallas. That's the man of organized crime that was so notorious and had links to the Watergate suspects and to the John Kennedy assassination suspects, the organized crime members. Robert Mayhew was living at the home of Moe Dallas, and they went to his office where there was a yellow, and they got a stack of messages on the yellow tablet paper that you normally used for writing messages. This is in 1974. I was surprised how few papers he had. There was just over an inch of them. And we said, is that all that you have? Because they wanted all the handwritten memos that Howard Hughes had written to Robert Mayhew collected so they wouldn't be in his possession. Yeah, they said, we want the papers that you normally used for writing messages. They put in the past tense, even though Howard Hughes lived two more years. So they said they asked for the entire amount, and Mayhew said that they're somewhere in the safe deposit box in the hotel, which is a funny place to put them, not a bank safe deposit. So they got the secretary, Ms. Nolan, of Robert Mayhew, and when she appeared, she had lost her key to the safe deposit box. She didn't know where that was. So we couldn't find the key, so we had one of the maintenance men who worked at the hotel drill through the door of the safe deposit box and open it. And they said this operation took 1.5 hours or more, and they swept up any memos that Robert Mayhew still had of Howard Hughes. And it said, I'm not 100% sure that he gave me the papers, but I put them in your room and turned them over. And that was the end. They later on to say that they were stolen and disappeared permanently. Any record of Howard Hughes' handwriting was gone, but they even blew open the box. The whole operation was a sweep in, take away all papers, break in the safe deposit, and empty it out and leave, 1.5 hours.
Well, that was kind of a theme that went through all the documents, was especially starting in about April of 1974, the Summa Corporation and the Hughes aides that were with him in Mexico went to great efforts to destroy all evidence of documents which were signed in handwriting by Howard Hughes. And they were, like, the president of Costa Rica sent a letter to Hughes, and they said that Hughes ought to acknowledge the receipt of the letter, but to please have someone else do it, because if Howard Hughes was to sign in his own hand, it goes on to say, yeah, if you communicated directly with him with the attendant risk that he may publicize a communication signed by you. This is from his lawyer, Chester Davis. And then Chester Davis goes on to tell Mr. Hughes how Mr. Hughes should answer his mail.
So a letter comes from the president of Costa Rica, but they can't stand the risk of sending an answer that would be signed by Howard Hughes. What reason? Why 1974? Why couldn't he sign his name?
Well, obviously he wasn't around to sign his name. We have some indication from these documents that they were forging his signature. In fact, we have one document which was an order or a motion that was put before the Utah District Court, Federal Judge Alden Anderson over there, in which there's a notation at the bottom of this first one says we can't use it, and an arrow points at a part of the signature which didn't conform to the standard Hughes signature. So they redid it and corrected the signature, and that was the one that they submitted to the court. So obviously it wasn't Hughes that was signing these things. But nonetheless, LeVar Myler went ahead and notarized these as having been signed in his personal presence. So I think that maybe that man might be in some trouble here.
Well, if they ever would have to go to court. How about his legal residence with Howard Hughes? They spell that out, don't they?
This is right. And, of course, we recall that my petition to Houston last fall was stating that Judge Alden Anderson in Utah had ruled that Hughes was a resident of Texas, and then he subsequently sealed up the record. And we find now a memo from this pile dated April 30, 1974, that the income tax returns of Hughes will continue to give the Exxon billing, formerly the Humble billing, as his address for purpose of income tax. So apparently,
so
they
Houston was his home address.
Yes, right. They were continuing to use that as his residence address in the United States.
If Romaine Street was the residence of the Summa Corporation, why wouldn't the taxes be paid out of there?
Well, that's it. We can't understand some of the reasons behind why they were doing what they did, but nonetheless, they continue to represent that Howard Hughes was a resident of Texas.
And the taxes came. How about the will? What about our documents from the will?
This is the one I think is most interesting, isn't it, Preston?
Yeah.
You're going to read this one.
This is a memo that has to do entirely with Hughes' will. And it goes on, while we were in Las Vegas, Nadine Henley, sent you a note. You told me that the note was about your will, and that Nadine thought you should review it. And anyway, evidently Nadine believes the will she has is the true will, and she must have been given instructions in the past by you to keep it secure. If the handwritten will is the real will, it could be that you had it updated later to the one Nadine has. Well, after all this time, why hasn't Nadine turned over that will?
And that's... it says, at any rate, wouldn't it be prudent to have Nadine send you the one she has under seal? That, and then whoever holds the handwritten one send to you in the same method. In other words, shouldn't, if he wants to update his own will, shouldn't she return the will he has for his own use?
Well, I think it's funny that neither one of those wills have turned up.
This memo is also dated, I believe it's 1975, isn't it? Yes. So, I wonder why Nadine hasn't come forth with that will that's in her possession.
Well, because if there's no will, a bulk of it goes to the Mormon Church, and we're back into the millions or billions for the Mormon Church. I mean, I don't know. I'm being naughty by making a guess. What do you think?
Well, I understand that Nadine is a member of the Mormon Church.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
And Bill Gay also?
The whole staff.
It would
right.
appear that the whole thing has been a conspiracy to skim off the entire assets of Hughes and to put them under the control of the Mormon Church.
Uh-huh. Do you have a favorite memo there about... we have some others we could just keep reading here. We'll share them. One thing that's interesting out of these memos that I think both Doug and Preston and Monty were surprised about were the large bunches of trivia and then a lot of memos about the kidnapping of Patty Hearst. Because I've maintained that the SLA was the CIA, and these memos about Patty Hearst come to the fact that Hughes is willing to give Randolph Hearst money.
Yeah, he
ransom
was willing
money.
To participate in the ransom money, it appears.
The food money, you know, that would pay for the food program,
right.
And so that they could take from one group and put it back in the other, just recycled CIA
yeah,
money.
Right.
See, and he followed the news accounts, the SLA shootout and the fire, and there's even one funny memo where they said, we better watch those terrorists because Bill Gates' home was broken into last night. I think they know who the terrorists were, but they were very concerned about Randolph Hearst and Patty Hearst.
Yes, that was evident through the memos there.
Yeah, in fact, there's one here. The Hearst Corporation is later going public and is interested in borrowing $100 million, and they're negotiating with the Chase Manhattan Bank. And he wanted to get into the action with the Hearst Corporation. He was very concerned with that. And that was in 1974.
Yes, yes. It appeared that they were interested in participating in some kind of a financing project with the Hearst Corporation.
Yeah.
They didn't say what the money was going to be used for, however.
Here's another one of April the 10th in 1974. The IRS is still discussing with me, this is Chester Davis, their need to question you personally in a number of difficult areas, which I will cover in another message. I made a lot of progress with them, but it is far from over.
Yes, and another thing that comes through these messages from Chester Davis is he mentioned one of them that he was walking a tightrope trying to keep Hughes from having to be personally present for a deposition.
Oh, that's right. He referred to their headquarters as a literal fortress.
Yes.
And there was even profanity. We have to keep something like the bastards out of here.
I
didn't bring that memo to the station. But there's a lot of profanity in this concern that we have a fortress and they're trying to break it.
Right.
Trying to get through to us. How about the Hughes Aircraft Company? I thought that was pretty funny, the executive meeting of the Hughes Aircraft. The executive committee of Hughes Aircraft for many years consists of Howard Hall and myself, Mr. Hyland. Howard, now retired from active duty at 70, and I'm still active at 76. So they asked for a meeting of the executive committee because one might die.
Right. They wanted to appoint someone else in there just in case one of them might die.
So then they had a board meeting, and three people, Mr. Hyland, Mr. Hall, and Hughes didn't show up?
That's right.
The executive meeting.
Which Hughes Corporation was it that hadn't had a board meeting since 1957?
Was that the Hughes Aircraft?
Hughes Aircraft, I believe. 1953.
Uh-huh.
Here's another one about Robert Mayhew.
Here it says the cross-examination of Mayhew started Friday and will resume Tuesday. This is Chester speaking. Chester Davis, I plan to return to Los Angeles to assist to the extent possible. Mayhew has testified from 1959 through 1970. He spoke to you. This is, of course, directed to Hughes. Personally, by telephone, approximately 25 times a year. And that once a year, he would inform you of the total amount he earned through fictitious billings, which had your approval.
Isn't that a good one? And, you know, sometimes he admitted he only talked to him once a year. He never really met him. He never met Howard Hughes. But 25 times a year running an empire that's getting $1.6 million every 24 hours from the taxpayers of the United States. And Mayhew is the conduit to that man, you know, from 57 up through 1970.
Right.
Or 1966, from the time of the Boston Hospital up through 70 exclusively. And talked to him I talked to some friends 35 times a day.
Yes.
I have certain friends that I talk on the phone with, you know.
Well, I think this is one of the startling revelations of these papers is the fact that all these memos are written, and we have very little evidence that there was ever face-to-face communication going on. There was no personal dialogue. Apparently, Chester would call in, and someone would record his message, and it would be then transferred in the form of a written memo to the alleged Hughes.
That's right.
No face-to-face communication.
And then we have one of a bank account. Preston, this is a good one. We have about 2 minutes.
Yeah, this is just after. This was 1974. I think when Hughes was still in London, and just before it goes on, just before you left London, you were given a memo explaining what should be done with some uncashed checks payable to you and some money you have in account in the First City National Bank of Houston, which has been dormant since 1957. It has been recommended that the uncashed checks be canceled and new checks be drawn for deposit in your account at the Texas Commerce Bank.
These checks sat around. See, 1957 is important because then Hughes was never seen visibly by any of his old friends or old guard or Dietrich or any of the people around him. No Dietrich or Terry Moore or anybody after 57.
Well, they probably hadn't perfected his hand signature yet, so they didn't dare endorse those checks for a deposit.
Very good. Right. See, three heads are better than one. That's right. This has been really exciting weekend for us. Going through this material and trying to assimilate it and understand it. But I really want to thank you, Doug, for coming down and bringing this stuff to me. I mean, this is really very great to be able to access
to these. Well, I appreciate the opportunity to do it, and I was fortunate I was able to get a hold of them, and I knew that you would be able to help evaluate this material.
And I will, and I want to thank Preston for coming here because I'll tell you all, he is the person that provided me with the William Colby Report. At the time of Watergate, to Senator Howard Baker, I think it was one of the first private people in the United States to have that.
Yeah.
And he handed that to me, that was several years ago, 3 years ago, right at the height of Watergate. And he got the letter and the full report of CIA Director William Colby to Howard Baker on covering up, how the Hughes people were covering up in the CIA, the investigation that would be going into hearings in May of 73. And it was written just prior, April, that report. Preston gave that to me. He was the source of that information. So we people who are called the Freedom Fighters, we work together, and I am grateful. I couldn't be doing this work without people like that bringing me these very precious documents and very precious friends. I really appreciate, and it's great to have them here, you know, working with me. I'll continue more about some of these documents at later time. And next week I'll be talking about the gallery article on George de Morenschult, Willem Altman's article. But now it's time to say goodbye. This is Mae Russell, and it's Dialogue Conspiracy in Carmel, California. We'll see you next Sunday night.
You've been listening to Dialogue Conspiracy with Mae Russell.